It's Thursday, June 1st. You thought Donald Trump was upset with DeSantis? Wait until his own vice president enters the race. We start here. Sources confirm Mike Pence is about to officially launch his presidential run.
I gotta say, I haven't sensed that he's really caught fire yet out here.
Our team is on the ground in Iowa as the field takes shape. Texas police said they caught a killer. Now they think they've got a serial killer.
Mr. Meza said he was ready and prepared to kill again, and he was looking forward to it.
But if their prime suspect is so dangerous, why was he let out of prison for good behavior? And teenagers' sex lives might not be as scandalous as you thought.
Less sex and also safer sex.
Why government officials say American teen pregnancy is lower than ever. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Last night, in the race to avoid default on America's debt, the House of Representatives gave a compromise bill a big green light.
Yeas are 314, the nays are 117. The bill is passed.
This is a bill that would keep one of the most basic parts of the financial system intact for the next couple years. That's what Democrats wanted. But in exchange, Republicans got several concessions. Now, any non-military program will basically see its funding stay flat for a couple years, regardless of inflation. Students will have to resume loan payments in August. Independent analysts say altogether this bill will knock more than $1 trillion off the national debt. Some on the left opposed it, even more on the right opposed it, but this bill was about the center holding, and it did. Next up is a Senate vote. But if you ask most of the candidates currently running for the GOP presidential nomination, they'll tell you this is a terrible deal.
We were careening towards bankruptcy before this debt deal, and the country is still careening towards bankruptcy after this debt deal.
It makes sense politically. After all, if you're looking to stand out from this crowded field, saying, yeah, we kind of take what we can get, that's not the most ambitious messaging.
Quit borrowing. Cut up the credit cards. Don't ever let them tell you Republicans and Democrats don't get along on anything because they love to spend your money.
But it speaks to how even if the majority of Americans want one thing right now, but winning in a primary is something different. And yesterday we learned that presidential field is growing even larger. ABC's chief Washington correspondent Jonathan Carl's been following President Trump for years, of course. For days, he's been on the tail of Trump's rival Ron DeSantis. But John, I want to start with this reporting overnight that Trump's former vice president is about to be where you are in Iowa. The Pence run. This is happening, it sounds like.
Pence is going to be here in Iowa. Joni Ernst has got this annual event. She has the senator from Iowa, called the Roast and Ride. And basically, they all come out. So not surprising that Pence is going to be here. But he is going to make it official, we're told. He's going to announce next week. We're told it will be on Wednesday that he is running for president. But it's been looking, let's be honest here, it's been looking like he's running for a long time. He's been out in Iowa a lot. I got to say, I haven't sensed that he's really caught fire yet out here. They're all basically, except for Trump and DeSantis, in single digits. But Pence is obviously somebody everybody knows. He just hasn't quite broken through yet. We'll see what happens when he actually becomes an official candidate.
Yeah, John, is the theory at this point for all these candidates, Pence, everyone, that there's got to be a Trump alternative? I want to be that person. I mean, what is there an appetite for a Trump alternative? What are you hearing as you go around Iowa?
Well, I have to tell you, just an observation after spending a few days here in Iowa and talking to a lot of Iowa Republicans, primarily people that have gone to these DeSantis events that I've been going to. You know how Iowa voters are. Iowa voters will remain undecided until the day before the caucuses because they want to see everybody. They want to see him multiple times. They want to go back and see him again. They want to talk to him. So the people that are going to DeSantis events are not DeSantis supporters at this point. They're interested in him. They something makes them curious about him. They're maybe inclined to like him. But I have to tell you, I am hearing something I haven't heard for a long, long time, which is a lot of very conservative Republicans saying negative things about Donald Trump.
It needs to be someone other than Trump. I think there's too much baggage with Trump, and so I'm hoping that DeSantis is maybe the person that it's going to be, but we want to learn more at this point.
These events are filled with Iowa Republicans, activist Iowa Republicans, kind of people that vote in caucuses, who are clearly interested in an alternative. That's why they're coming out to see DeSantis. But how freely they talk about how they don't think Trump can win, how they really liked him as a president. They supported him in 2016. They supported him in 2020. But they're, you know, tired of the drama.
I think Donald Trump was great for what we needed in 2016. But I think he's so polarizing. I think we need a uniter at this time in the country, not somebody that's polarizing that's going to keep people apart.
And they want new blood. Now, I don't know if Mike Pence, you know, in that perspective, does Mike Pence count as new blood? I'm not so sure.
Is DeSantis that new blood, though, John? Like, as you talk to people, is it clear that they favor one candidate over another, like a Ron DeSantis? Or is it like just an ever-growing list of candidates who aren't Trump? Like, they all just fit in one huge bucket.
He's clearly getting a look. I mean, people are turning out. You know, he's getting decent-sized crowds. It's certainly not Trump-sized crowds. It's certainly not Trump-sized energy at these events. But people know who Ron DeSantis is. His message in these speeches, and by the way, one thing that's been noticeable to me is in Ron DeSantis' stump speech, it's almost word for word at every event. He hits those culture war issues, you know, about his, you know, all the various battles he's had in Florida. He talks about sending the undocumented immigrants off to Martha's Vineyard, and he gets big applause on this stuff. I don't know that he's going to catch fire, but he's certainly getting the opportunity because people are curious about him and want to hear what he has to say.
How nasty is this race going to get, like, starting right now? John, I'm thinking of Pence getting into the race. I'm thinking of, we got new reporting showing that Chris Christie is indeed going to throw his hat in the ring. He's like a political pugilist. And then just when we talk about Ron DeSantis and former President Trump, their staffers are getting increasingly personal with each other. I mean, Trump himself went after his former aide, Kayleigh McEnany, yesterday, called her milquetoast, even though she was one of the people really sticking up for him on January 6th. We saw Ron DeSantis' aides like taking shots at Trump's military service or lack thereof during the Memorial Day weekend. I mean, what is this race about to look like?
Well, certainly when you have Trump in a race, he's willing to go brutal. He's held his fire against just about everybody else except DeSantis, because obviously he thinks DeSantis is the biggest threat. And he's been brutal.
The problem with Ron DeSanctimonious is that he needs a personality transplant, and those are not yet available.
He has spent more money with his political organizations attacking Ron DeSantis with television ads than he spent in the entire 2022 cycle to support Republican candidates. And he's attacked him on the stump. He's attacked him in interviews. He's given him his nickname, obviously. He's made crude personal allegations against DeSantis. And DeSantis, for months, basically didn't respond at all. Now DeSantis is responding.
6 months ago, he would have never said that, right? He used to say how great Florida was. Hell, his whole family moved to Florida under my governorship. Are you kidding me?
He suggests Trump's not a conservative. He suggested he has no idea about, you know, Supreme Court justices. If I'm president, I won't need somebody to give me a list to tell me, you know, what a conservative justice looks like, referring to the Federalist Society list that Trump worked from. This is the beginning. I think there's the potential to get a lot nastier. And obviously, Chris Christie will have no hesitation whatsoever to go after Trump in much harsher ways than DeSantis is.
All right, John Carl there on the road as we speak in Iowa. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, police think he's a serial killer, but the family of his previous victim is asking why he was on the streets. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We go after the worst of the worst. And we list Raul Meza as one of those individuals.
This week, officials in Texas have announced they made an arrest in a murder case. A man who allegedly admitted to killing his elderly roommate. But then, something else happened. Police said he was also suspected of another recent killing, and now he's being investigated for several others. As in, They think they might have a serial killer in custody. And what's most frustrating to local residents about all this is not someone cops had never encountered before. In fact, he had already been convicted of murder once. ABC's Maria Villarreal is based in Texas. Maria, what is going on here?
So this is obviously a very convoluted and complicated case. It goes back decades. And so the man we're talking about is Raul Meza Jr. And he does have a very long storied history with police. But we have to talk obviously about what got us here in the first place.
Pflugerville police are now treating an elderly man's death as a homicide. And they say the suspect in his death is a convicted killer, well known to longtime Central Texans.
This started on May 20th when family members were concerned about Jesse Fraga. This is an 80-year-old man that was living with Raul Meza Jr. They said, listen, police in Pflugerville, Texas, please go and check things out. We haven't heard from him in about a week. They did, and that's when they found Mr. Fraga dead.
On May the 24th, Raul Meza called the Austin Police Department 311 line, and he was transferred to the homicide line.
I answered the homicide main line, and the caller stated, my name is Raul Meza, and you're looking for me.
At the time, Pflugerville police put out, you know, an alert warning the public that they were looking for this man. He was actually driving the victim's vehicle, a Toyota Tundra.
If you know where Meza is, you're asked to please call Pflugerville police.
And then that's when an urgent manhunt ensued.
This was old-fashioned law enforcement work, going door to door, going hotel to hotel, receiving intelligence by tips that are coming in.
Pflugerville police actually got involved with the Lone Star Fugitive Task Force. A bunch of other departments got involved.
On his search incident to arrest, he had a bag with him, and in that bag contained zip ties, duct tape, flashlight, and a .22 caliber pistol with additional rounds in that bag.
But also, while he was admitting to police that he had killed his roommate, he also said that he was responsible for an unsolved murder that had been sitting within the Austin Police Department for quite a while, a woman named Gloria Lofton.
Meza described his life in and out of prison and said, I quote, I got out in 2016. I end up murdering a lady soon afterwards. It was on Sarah Drive.
He gave officers very detailed information about that murder that had not been released to the public. They checked DNA and it matched up with Mr. Meza.
Well, and so he's been arrested over these two killings, it appears, but his backstory has also kind of infuriated people there who said, how did you not have eyes on this guy? I mean, why is that?
So when law enforcement talked about these two most recent cases, they brought up an assistant city manager by the name of Bruce Mills.
Kind of hard to believe, and I get a call on Friday about a case that was, 40 years since I even ever saw the case, ever saw the details, and I remember it like it was yesterday.
And initially you're like, well, what is an assistant city manager doing talking about, you know, murder cases? Well, it turns out that Mr. Mills was actually the primary investigator in a 1982 case where an 8-year-old little girl was sexually assaulted and also murdered.
8-year-old Kendra Page found, January 3rd, right after the Christmas holidays, found deceased behind Langford Elementary School.
Raul Meza was convicted of that murder. He actually was sentenced to 30 years in jail. It was actually, though, a plea agreement that got him there.
We were shocked, disappointed, with no really explanation as to why this case didn't go to trial.
He served 11 years and then was up for parole and got out on good behavior. Mm. That was in the early 90s.
Her death set Austin on edge. Parents stopped letting their kids walk to school. Big crowds gathered at neighborhood meetings to find ways to keep kids safe.
The family of Kendra Page, the 8-year-old little girl that was killed, is up in arms. They're trying to keep him in jail. They were very concerned that he would do something again to someone else. In fact, there were protests in the streets of Austin.
We want him out! We need to protest! We don't want him in our neighborhood! Everybody come out of your house now!
People who were really worried about him getting out and where he would live and could he do something like this again. What was so crazy about it is as Mr. Meza is getting out, he actually holds a press conference shortly after being released.
I am fully aware that because of the errors of my negligent youth, society now sees me as a threat to public safety.
And says to the community, once again, you have nothing to worry about. I am reformed.
I can only tell you that in my heart, I know that I will not willfully bring harm to anyone.
And then shortly after being released and after holding that press conference back in the early 90s, he is taken back in for violating his parole. So he goes back to jail again.
Oh, so like if the 11 years were considered lenient because in the authorities' eyes, they trust him. Well, you normally don't get more leniency after you break your parole. So, I mean, how long did he go back to jail for then?
So after kind of taking a look at the history of all this, it does look like after he goes to jail back in 1994 or around that time frame, he spends about a decade or so in jail. And then he was released again. Remember, he's in jail at the time for violating his parole. At the time, law enforcement didn't have any reason to believe he had committed any other crimes. But now fast forward to 2023, and here we are with the death of 80-year-old Jesse Fraga. And now the admittance of the fact that there could be another case back in 2018.
But I will let you know that Mr. Meza said he was ready and prepared to kill again, and he was looking forward to it. So
it's safe to call him a serial killer?
Yes.
And as investigators were discussing this, these two most recent cases, they basically tell the media, oh, by the way, we do believe there could be multiple cold cases that Mr. Meza was involved in. We're going back all the way to 1996.
Right now, we have between 8 and 10 cases that kind of fit the similar circumstances that we're looking at, but that could obviously grow.
Bruce Mills, the lead investigator from the 82 case, said it himself.
So here's a serial killer that justice was not served. So it was a travesty of justice, totally in this case.
And who knows how many more people are out there suffering because of him.
Well, and the bizarre thing is here, again, just how many people were sort of ready to vouch for him. In fact, the 80-year-old who was killed in this most recent murder, and we still haven't heard a plea from the suspect here, but this 80-year-old who was killed was actually a probation officer and had said, according to police, that he was rehabilitating this man who is now alleged to be his killer. All right, Maria Villarreal, wild story there in Texas. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Brad.
This last year has been perhaps the most consequential year for American reproductive health in the last half century. The reason for ending Roe v. Wade in the eyes of many of its opponents was there's a crisis of morality among Americans right now, specifically young Americans. Women, the argument went, have become so okay with becoming pregnant because they know they can go out and get an abortion. And yet overnight, new research came out contradicting that. This report from the CDC shows that teen pregnancies are the lowest the agency has ever recorded. Nicole Wetzman is a reporter with ABC's medical unit. Nicole, what are these numbers telling us?
Yeah, so we are looking at the lowest teen birth rate ever in the United States. This isn't necessarily a huge surprise. Teen birth rates have pretty much been on the decline for the past, 20, 30 years. There's been kind of a steady decrease other than kind of a slight bump in 2006. But overall, we've seen birth rates declining overall largely since 1991. And that's across all the teenage years, so 15 to 17, 18 to 19.
From 2007 to 2015, the teen birth rate has decreased 46%. And from 1991 to 2015, it has decreased 64%.
They declined, 3% since last year. So we're looking at the lowest number of teen births ever in the United States in 2022, according to kind of provisional data released by the CDC as part of this larger report on birth rates in the United States.
And why? Do we know what the difference makers are, both in the last year, but also, this broader trend that you're talking about?
Yeah, so it's a combination of factors. Some of the main things that folks point to when we talk about drops in teen pregnancy rates are one, teens having less sex. And also it's access to more and more effective birth control.
We're counseling toward these highly effective forms of birth control. We're seeing that these teen pregnancy rates are dropping. I don't think that is a coincidence.
So access to birth control pills, to IUDs, to Plan B, you need to take emergency contraceptive, condoms, things like that.
86% of females aged 15 to 19 years old and 93% of males within the same age group have used some form of contraception at their last sexual encounter.
I'd say kind of twofold is, you know, less sex and also safer sex.
Then part of me wonders that, like, it's not just abortion rights that are being examined right now. We've been talking about Plan B, like you mentioned. We're talking about birth control in a lot of states around the country. So is, at this moment, is the expectation that these numbers will keep declining, or are we at an inflection point here? Could numbers go back up again, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it is still too early to say. We sort of are in this point where we're trying to figure out, okay, what is going to happen to reproductive health, pregnancy, birth in the United States now that abortion protections are lifted?
What is it going to be next? Is that judge going to not like birth control pills? Are we going to have a judge that doesn't like Lipitor?
Now that we have kind of more attacks than we have seen in the past couple of years on things like birth control, things like Plan B, things like that. So I would say it kind of remains to be seen exactly how this is going to shake out. But if you are restricting access to reproductive care, sometimes that can lead to pregnancy and birth. And I think it is an if access to birth control is kind of the driving factor in some of these drops. It's not unreasonable to question whether or not we're going to see some of this rebound. But again, I think it is way too early to say for sure what we're going to see in the next couple of years.
Yeah. And I was going to say, you also mentioned teens are just having less sex. Is there, again, you keep saying like multi-factors. Are there a reason, like, are there a list of factors of why teens are just having less sex in general?
That one's a little bit hard to suss out. There's definitely been some survey data kind of looking at risky behavior for teens, things like alcohol, drug use, and sex. And we are kind of seeing drops. I think there's probably a lot of factors that contribute to that as well. We have fewer third spaces in America right now, so just places where people can congregate, especially young people. So less kind of unrestricted free time for young people in the U.S., fewer places to go that are kind of outside of the home and school to kind of spend time socializing. So I think those, you know, could be contributing, but I think it's like a very complex issue and has to do with, you know, a lot of different factors in cultural life in America right now.
Yeah, cultural and macroeconomic things. All right, really interesting. Nicole Wetzman from our medical unit. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, if you like winning money, the odds of you sticking around are high. One last thing is next. And one last thing. To the average person, a Las Vegas casino is overwhelming. Bright lights, loud sounds. But to casino management, it all comes down to numbers. How much money are you taking in and how much are you paying out to gamblers? Blackjack is often considered the table game with the best odds in the house. Well, that could be changing. When we talk about Vegas casinos, you're not allowed inside most of these, right?
As long as I'm not playing blackjack, I'm welcome to visit the properties.
That's Micah Ponte, one of the most famous blackjack players in the world. In fact, the movie 21 is based on him and his former classmates.
I was kind of one of the leaders of the MIT card counting team.
He says across the board, every game at the casino is designed, of course, for the house to win, but some are more tilted than others. You might have a good night or a bad night, but if you play thousands of hands of blackjack, the casino should only take a little bit of your money.
If you follow basic strategy, then the house edge only is about 0.5%.
But last year, according to data from the Nevada Gaming Commission, blackjack players lost more cash than they have in nearly two decades. That's not because there are just more people playing. In part, it's because the odds have changed.
Kind of started about 15, 20 years ago where the casinos started introducing rule changes to kind of increase their advantage.
So remember the basic rules of blackjack, right? You get two cards, the dealer gets two cards, whoever's closest to 21 without going over wins. Simple. And the stakes are 1-1. You put down 10 bucks, you get 10 bucks in profit if you win. Except when you get dealt exactly 21. That's called a blackjack.
And the beauty of blackjack is that the player will get a 3-2 payout on their wager, which is equivalent to 150%.
Oh, so you put down $10. Instead of getting $10 in profit, you get 15 bucks back next to your chips.
Exactly.
And that little bonus payment, Mike says, it's key. It's one of the biggest reasons you can make back your money quicker. It's why the house edge is so low. Well, casinos over time have slowly lowered that blackjack payout. According to John Mahaffey, the founder of this group called Vegas Advantage, which literally goes around town counting table stakes, about two-thirds of blackjack tables now only give you 6-5 odds for that coveted blackjack, which didn't seem like a big deal to me at first, still a bonus. But Mike, our blackjack expert, says that means Vegas is taking more of its customers' money.
Just simply lower that payout to 6-5, now the house edge goes up to 1.9%. I mean, it nearly quadruples.
The reasoning for casinos seems pretty simple. Like, if there's more money to be taken, take it. But you might think, wait a minute, wouldn't that stop gamblers from coming to Vegas? Mike says he thought it would, but it's been just the opposite. Last year was a record year for casino gambling. That's the irony here. As Vegas becomes more of a tourist destination than a pure gambling destination, the gambling dollars actually get bigger. That's when Mike said something that really blew my mind.
They can really get away with it at the lower limit tables because they don't institute the, like, they're at a higher limit table, they're never going to do 6-5.
Oh, so there might be different odds at different areas of the casino, you're saying. Like high rollers area, all of a sudden they're different odds maybe.
Yes, yeah. So that's a big change back from when I first started playing. When I started playing, like, the rules were the same throughout the entire casino for the most part.
And that is the real takeaway here. High rollers have always been treated differently in Vegas from the rest of us. But now, just like so many other aspects in life, the rich have a chance to get richer quicker with literal different rules because all those with shorter stacks are seen as a little bit more expendable. That said, if you want to keep more of your money, Mike says, the answer is not to find a table with higher stakes and better odds. Don't bet your house or anything. The answer is to treat it like entertainment, play within your means, and set a limit, because the house is winning either way. We were talking about how corporate Vegas has become, and Mike says the fact that he's now allowed in the building shows you how much has changed. Like, he used to be public enemy number one. Now he's in Vegas giving speeches. He goes to conferences there. He's an attraction, like Katy Perry or Deadmau5. I'm no Deadmau5, but you can bet your bottom dollar this podcast will still be free. You'll get that bang for your buck. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.